This is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. Since graduating from the University of North Carolina School of the Arts, tenor Rene Barbera has quickly established himself as a rising star on today's opera circuit. Opera Today wrote that his performance, quote, had us so bewitched we scarcely dared breathe, lest any sound break the honeyed perfection, end quote. Well, this weekend, Rene brings that perfection to Greensboro Opera's production of Gaetano Donizetti's The Daughter of the Regiment. He's joined by Metropolitan Opera soprano Ashley Emerson as Marie, conducted by Arizona Opera conductor laureate Joel Revson, and directed by David Holly, who dropped by to chat with me about the program. Rene spoke with me from his home in San Antonio, Texas. Remind our listeners of the story.
Absolutely. Marie is an orphan. She was orphaned and left on the battlefield, and she was raised by all the men of the 21st Regiment, and so they all consider themselves her father. They all have felt very protective, very instrumental in raising. She's a tomboy. She loves just being with the men, and in the first act, they ask her, please sing the song of the regiment, and she's hesitant to do it. They all consider her their own daughter, and it turns out that she was out hiking on a mountaintop and almost fell, and she was saved by the enemy. See, the story takes place when the Napoleonic French army was fighting a couple-year conflict against the Tyroleans, and so the Tyroleans are an enemy, and sure enough, the tenor, Tonio, is Tyrolean. He saved her life, and so we have boy meets girl, boy loves girl, and they fall in love, but it's forbidden because they're enemies. It kind of sounds like Romeo and Juliet. Marie is actually the daughter of the Marquise, a wealthy family, and the Marquise shows up, and she actually recognizes her, takes her to the home because she wants to marry her off to the Duke of Crackenthorpe. She wants to get into some arranged marriage money. So the second act is the play out of that. She's taken away from the regiment, and it's all about setting up this arranged marriage, and the Duchess comes to the home and with her son, and it all turns out that Marie and the Duke are actually brother and sister because they have the same father, basically, and so they can't get married. And so Tonio and Marie get each other in the end. It's a happy ending for all.
Okay. Well, tell me about this amazing tenor, Rene Barbera, and besides that range, what makes him so special?
Well, Rene, in 2007, was an undergraduate at School of the Arts, and at that time, we were in our third year of the Charles Lynham Vocal Competition at UNCG. And it had two divisions, an artist division and young artist, and Rene entered the young artist division, and he sang A Mes Amis as an undergrad at School of the Arts, and he won the competition. With that aria, and Dmitry Sitkovetsky, our conductor over at the Greensboro Symphony, heard him as part of the prize of winning the competition was an appearance with the symphony. So not only did he win the competition, but then he appeared with the symphony the next year in 2008 singing that aria. So Greensboro audiences have heard him sing that. And of course, then 3 years later, 2011, he entered Placido Domingo's Operalia competition, which is probably the largest competition in the world. And yet again, use that aria, he won that competition. And there are three parts of that competition: the opera, the zarzuela, which is Spanish type opera, and then the audience favorite. He was the only artist since 1993 is when that competition started to win all three of those categories. And you go on YouTube, you can see that somebody had a camera phone in the audience and actually taped that winning performance singing that aria. So I wanted to build a production around him. So when I first got the idea for Greensboro Opera to produce an opera in this time slot, I called him first and said, let's build a production around you. I'd love to have you do Tonio, since that's kind of your signature aria and what you won the competition with.
When did you realize that you weren't just a good singer, Rene, but you were, you had potential to be a professional opera singer? Take me back to that transition.
I was in choirs and I was in fifth grade. I started as a boy soprano, and I've kind of always been a performer. I started with piano when I was young, but my high school choir director was the first one to kind of tell me that I could really do something with this career. And I didn't really believe it at the time, and I thought to myself, this is kind of a long shot. This doesn't make sense. I don't know what he's talking about. But what I did want to do is I wanted to be a high school choir director like he was, because he influenced me so much, and he was such a positive figure when I was going through high school. Those are interesting times as a young guy. I auditioned for a scholarship at the University of Texas at San Antonio, And I got the biggest scholarship they offered, and there was a kind of a hubbub about my singing, and didn't really understand it so much. But the teacher I selected to work with me kind of told me, you know, I was 30, and I still couldn't sing that aria you just sang so well, which was "Comfort Ye Every Valley." And at the time, I think I was 18 or 19. So he pushed me towards performance. He said, you know, you really should do performance. I think you have a lot of potential, and I think you could really do this. And so kind of from there on out, I got a lot of positive feedback and kept telling me, you know, you should do this, you should do this, you should do this. And despite trying to quit repeatedly, I somehow ended up still singing. And when I turned 22, actually, I had a really, really bad breakup. And I decided to go ahead and go full tilt and really get some work done and actually focus on singing. And that's kind of when everything started falling in line, and I realized that maybe I actually could go for this and do this legitimately.
You mentioned that you kind of came in and out of singing for a period there, maybe in your early 20s. What sorts of things would have you derail for periods of time?
The first time I tried to quit was when I was in ninth grade. I decided I didn't want to be in choir. And within the first week of being in school, I bumped into my choir director, who knew me because I sang a Pia Jesu with, I think it was a Fode Requiem, with, I think it was the San Antonio Choral Society. Well, he twists my ear and drops me to my knees and says, "You will be in my choir by the end of the week." So that was the first time. The second time I tried to quit, I moved to Colorado with my brother, and I started with a company, Elite Auto Glass. And I was doing windshield repairs and windshield replacements out of car washes. And I was doing quite well, actually. My boss, when I was interviewing, you know, we had all, you know, the usual talk about work and blah, 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 blah. But then we took a break to have lunch. And he said, you know, the only time I've seen your eyes light up is when you spoke about singing. I mean, the moment you spoke about singing, I could tell you were involved and you liked it, you know, and I'm going to be on you because I know this is not your future career, you know, doing windshield repairs. You're not going to do this for the rest of your life. You're going to be a singer, and I'm going to be on you to get in contact with a voice teacher here in Colorado area, because I had mentioned that there was a teacher in Colorado Springs that I wanted to study with, Martiel Roland. I had been having trouble getting in contact with her, but I was being persistent, and every week he literally would call me every week and say, and, you know, say, "Hey, have you called her? Have you gotten in contact with her yet? Okay, keep trying. Let me know when you have. And if you ever need time off, you know, you got it. Just let me know. Just give me a little bit of time to plan ahead, and you can have it as much as you want." And sure enough, I did get in contact with Martiel, and he gave me 3 weeks off, and he said, "Listen, man, I get a feeling you're not coming back after this, but I need you to tell me as soon as you can if you're coming back to me or not, you know, if you're going to work this, you know, with us anymore after this this summer program." So I did the Vocal Arts Symposium, which was the 3 weeks I took off. And through there, I met a few people from the North Carolina School of the Arts who were the teachers there and several of the students. And evidently, I found out years later that Jamie Albritton, who was at the time the main conductor for the chorus, among other things, many, many, many hats he wore at the North Carolina School of the Arts, had told some of his students to recruit me. So, and it worked, and I ended up going there within a few months of moving to Colorado. So that was my second stint at going, or third stint, whatever it was, going back to singing. And then, of course, throughout my entire time at North Carolina School of the Arts, I was just rebellious and didn't really want to do the work. I didn't really want to be a singer, but I had a girlfriend, and I didn't leave because she was around. And so that was that. And after that, right towards the end of my schooling at the School of the Arts, my very last production was Street Scene, and it was really kind of brutal. I was Lippo Fiorentino, and I just got so tired of the rehearsal schedule, and I was so exhausted because, you know, we're in school from 8 o'clock to 5. We maybe have an hour for dinner, maybe an hour and a half if we're lucky. Then we're in rehearsal till 11. It's supposed to be 10, but inevitably it lasted until 11, which drove me nuts. One of my biggest pet peeves is getting a schedule where I'm told we're going to be done at this time. So then I start planning to be done at that time, both from a physical, emotional standpoint and also from, okay, what am I going to do afterward? I got papers to write. I got this and that to do. And so inevitably the extra hour would drive me up the wall. And on top of that, being Street Scene, the final scene, where the entire chorus is on stage and everybody kind of has their own job because it's a town and everybody kind of has to have their own identity. And you're working with each individual person so much, you know, Lippo Fiorentino, myself, was sitting in a very small room in the house, looking out the window for hours on end, basically sitting there waiting for the rest of it to get done. And I was losing my mind and I was ready to quit again. And I said, you know what, I'm going to ride it out and I'm going to go to Marilla. And if I hate it, If I hate Marilla and I can't stand it, then I'm going to quit and I'm done. But if I like it, that'll be it. I'll stick around. And sure enough, within the first week of being at Marilla, I was in love.
Tell me a little bit about Marilla.
It was my first young artist program, and I was just really happy when I got there. You know, I finally got to work specifically on singing and music, and that was it. There was nothing else. There was no classes, no silly academics that just, you know, that tried to bring an artistic viewpoint into, like, things like geology and that sort of thing. It's like, okay, come on, let's treat this as an academic. But it was just great to be able to finally just focus on singing and work with people and have time off. I mean, when we first got there, the people at Marilla were saying, "Oh, it's going to be the busiest time ever. This is not a vacation. You're going to work a lot," and blah blah blah. And we did. You know, we rehearsed, you know, from like 10 to 5, as is pretty normal. But for me, that was a vacation because I was used to going 8 a.m. until 11 p.m. So every time I got off of work at 5, I'm like, "You got to be kidding! This is amazing." And every time I didn't go to work until 10, I'm like, "Okay, this is great. I can do this. You know, this is something I can actually accomplish." And so it would actually kind of did feel like a vacation, at least from the standpoint of not having to go the whole day and night even. And so it was just a great experience. I got to work with a lot of wonderful people. I met a lot of great colleagues, some of which I still see pretty regularly, actually.
Besides the union busting rules and hours of rehearsal and the schoolwork schedule there, what was a takeaway experience you had at UNCSA? You know, something that you've turned to since then in terms of your approach to music or whatever?
Well, there's a lot, actually. I mean, it's, for all the negative I spoke just now, I mean, it's not so much about the school. It's just my own ability to maintain a schedule like that. But what it did, one of the many things it did, was prepared me for the times when I was really, really busy. Because there have been those moments when I was a young artist at the Lyric Opera Chicago. There were weeks that I was working, you know, every day of the week, you know, doing overtime and extra things because I was in multiple productions at once. And I learned a lot about, well, for one, being a good colleague. I also learned about, well, how to behave as an artist, as a principal artist, and also how to be politically correct when you're speaking to somebody. When I was much younger, I had somewhat of a temper, and I did not deal well with what I decided was, you know, BS, essentially. And to this day, I still sort of don't, but I'm better about it. I know how to present myself, and if something bothers me, I don't immediately get frustrated or upset. It's like, okay, well, this is bugging me. How do I approach this in a respectful and professional manner? And so that's a lot of what I learned there. And, you know, you learned a few things of what not to do as well. But because of the people there, Jamie Albritton, Steve Lacoste, and Marilyn Taylor, of course, they put up with a lot of my nonsense for a long time, and they didn't stop believing in me. And, you know, there was a lot of tough love at times, but it got me through. And, I look back on it with incredibly fond memories. And, you know, one of the things that I miss most right now is working with Jamie Albritton as a conductor. He's such a wonderful conductor, and, I'm dying to work with him again. I really learned what hard work was. Even though I was still a slacker and didn't work as hard as maybe some of my friends and colleagues there, it certainly was the hardest I have ever had to work in my life with regard to just how much I had to do. And that alone was enough to prepare me to deal with pretty much anything. If I survived 4 years there, I could survive it anywhere.
Yeah, there and New York.
New York, oh gosh. I can't survive New York. No, I can't do New York.
Nobody can do that. Hey, David Holly got us up to speed on the story behind The Daughter of the Regiment. I mean, this has become, according to David, and from what I'm seeing online, sort of a signature role for you. What do you love most about Donizetti's music in broad strokes, and maybe this role, this opera in particular?
Well, it's interesting. This role has actually not become one of my signature roles. The aria I've sung repeatedly. However, I've only done this opera once. I'm dying to do it again. It's a beautiful piece, and it's my first time doing it in French, which is really exciting. So I've been really stressed about the French. But Donizetti's music, for whatever reason, I feel the music like I don't feel most anything else. You know, Donizetti and Bellini specifically, but Donizetti, there's something about his music. Maybe it's because it's so Italianate. I just kind of feel it. I don't know. It's just wonderful. I love it so much. It gives me the opportunity to do a lot of things. There's a little bit of coloratura. There's definitely, you know, peppy, happy music, but then there's these long, legato, beautiful lines. And just listening to some of it, I mean, Il faut partir that Marie sings when she's, you know, bidding adieu to everyone, basically. It's just heart-wrenching, beautiful music. Thank you. there's just so much to love about Donizetti in general, and the things that I've done of his. You know, I've done Nemorino a couple of times now, and I did Lucia, Edgardo once, I should say. I did Arturo and Lucia as well. But there's something about the way the music is written. There's something about the characters he chooses that just make it really wonderful. You know, so far I haven't done any weak characters with Donizetti's music and the stories that he's written to. I love it so much. It's one of the things that I want to sing more of Donizetti. I don't get to sing a lot of Donizetti. I sing mostly Rossini these days. Hopefully there'll be more Donizetti in my future.
His melodies always grab me. I mean, they sound sometimes as if they could have been written yesterday, although they're, you know, clearly from the period. I love the triumphant melody in Mes Amis, and this is an aria that you make sound so easy, but I know it's not. Talk about your preparation for that moment, how you've managed to make it sound comfortable through the years.
Well, you know, with the high Cs, to be honest, this aria just in general is actually much easier than the second aria. The second aria is far more exposed and it's way more difficult because there's a legato. You have to form beautiful lines. You have to have great breath. You have to, you know, actually caress a few lines and have a lot of dynamic contrast versus Mes Amis, which is basically all upbeat, happy, popping out high notes. And, you know, there's not really a lot of difficult music in it. For me, the high notes have never been a problem, so I didn't really have to do much to get the high Cs there. It was just a matter of stamina, just kind of like, okay, well, let's do this as many times as we can in a row and make sure that no matter what happens, I got this.
It's interesting. I was speaking with a soprano the other day who was talking to... Oh, it was Madame Butterfly. She was talking about just how the challenge really in that role is that mid-range and sustaining the mid-range for so long through various arias, not the traditional, you know, the high singing that we've become so accustomed to thinking is the real virtuosic stuff.
Yeah, that's something that I've encountered before. The middle range actually can be far more taxing than the high.
Now, I understand that you've worked with soprano Ashley Emerson, who plays Marie before, and in this same role. That's got to be a comfort.
It'll be a lot of fun. It's actually the first time I ever did it was in St. Louis in English. So it'll be fun to rehash it and see what it's like. Ashley is an absolute blast on stage. She's a whole lot of energy and she's just really easy to play off of.
What are you looking forward to most with regard to this production?
Well, I mean, one of the things I'm just really excited about is just being back in the Triad area. You know, it's been so long since I've sung there. It's been equally long, it seems, since I've been there. You know, it'd be great to be around friends and colleagues, and I'm going to get to go and work one-on-one with Marilyn Taylor and get to see Jamie and Steve, of course, and just, you know, that's all very exciting. But for me, I guess the most exciting thing is that I get to actually do this opera finally in French. And, you know, only the second time, for whatever reason, no matter how much I've sung the aria, I've only been hired for it twice.
Have you worked with David Holly before?
No, not directly. I've met him several times, but this will be the first time actually working together.
Yeah, he said he was looking forward to he's putting together essentially an entire production created for you. I mean, what's that like?
Well, it's flattering. It's very flattering. I feel like there's a lot of pressure on me to perform, but it's very flattering.
Well, I know you're going to hit it out of the park. I was just online listening to from Bellini, you have a little clip there from Misera from this 2013 recording.
Capitani.
Yeah. And you're belting out a high F. I mean, that's young Michael Jackson territory. What's got to be in place vocally, I mean, to make that happen?
It's an interesting thing. For number one, it depends on the rest of the opera. You know, if you're struggling the whole opera, you know, you're having a rough night or whatever, the tempi's are wrong, anything like that, if you're even the slightest bit tired, that F is really treacherous. It's interesting because the way that particular part was done, I was only seeing the last few performances, and the tenor before me had not done the F, so they had reorchestrated the parts to accommodate that. So I had to actually change the way it's written to sing it, which actually made it more difficult. So basically, what it entailed was me being paranoid as all kinds of hell backstage, sitting there trying to make sure that I had it, you know, throughout all parts of it, and kind of deciding, okay, which one am I going to do? Am I going to do the F tonight, or am I going to do the, you know, the D? And you know, it was scary. I have to confess, every time it was like, okay,
this could be a crash and burn. Let's go for it. And luckily, it went well. I had a fun time, and it really, like I said, it was very nerve wracking. But it's one of those notes that you either have it that day or you don't. You know, there's no kind of fixing it. It's like, okay, that's there, we're good. Or you wake up and say, no, that's not going to happen today. But yeah, it's an interesting note because it kind of goes into one place and one place only. So you know if it's there. It's very different, like E-flat for me, for whatever reason. I can wake up and sing it any day of the week. It's just, it's in one place and it's easy. But this one, no. This one's kind of it's a little wishy-washy. I have to warm up to like a high G or high A to actually sing it with confidence.
Oh, you've got to sing above the note and then come back down to it and feel... Does that just relax your throat in a certain way? What does that do?
You know, I really don't know, physiologically speaking, what exactly happens. I just know that if I can sing above it, then I'm safer to sing it. You know what I mean? So I always sing a whole step at least, and sometimes higher than my highest note for a show, just to make sure that... Okay, I'm golden, even if my voice comes down a little bit throughout the show, depending on what, you know, if I'm singing in my middle range all the time, you know, the higher notes can start to kind of come down and say, well, you know, you've been settling kind of low. We're not going to work because you're not using us.
Okay, I got you. Just a quick anecdote. It was from an interview with Pavarotti on the Charlie Rose show. And Pavarotti's asked, hey, what are you thinking when you're backstage getting ready to go out in front of the Met? And Pavarotti says, I am killing myself. I'm saying, why do you do this? My heart is racing a million times a second. I can't believe you do. Why do you do this to yourself? I tell myself. And then I go on stage and I sing the first line and then it's all right.
I've had that conversation with myself before, though. And it's usually only when I'm doing something new that I've never done before. But it's the same sort of thing for me. I go out there and as soon as I sing a first line, any worries that I have, they kind of just go away because it's like, you know, you're a different person on stage. You're a character. And for me, I feel like I'm in my element. You know, it's like it's home to me. In fact, when I was in Paris, this is an interesting story. When I was in Paris, I was really sick the final week and I had been on prednisone. And the night before the final show, I had gone to the emergency room. I was taken by the paramedics to the emergency room in an ambulance because the prednisone was having a reaction with me and I was having heart palpitations. So I was freaking out, and I thought I was dying. So that was late at night. I didn't get to the hospital until like 1 o'clock in the morning. I didn't get home until like 4. So the next night, getting ready to go on stage, I start having a panic attack, again, because of the prednisone. I was convinced that I was going to go out there and die. Literally, I was terrified. And I wasn't about singing. I literally thought that I was going to have like an aneurysm or something on stage. For whatever reason, that's where my mind went because of the prednisone. The prednisone was messing with me because I was on such a high dose. It was really messing with me really badly. And, you know, I was emotionally a wreck. I almost cried like 3 times right before going on. And it was terrifying. You know, I was really scared. And, you know, I kind of paced a lot backstage. And I finally just went on. And I did. And I sang the aria, which was kind of rough. And it was difficult. It was the hardest I've ever had to sing, you know, the first aria of the Barber of Seville. But I got through it. And once I got through it, in fact, once I got to about a quarter of the way through the aria, I kind of calmed down and I felt okay again. And I felt great afterward. I felt wonderful afterward. But literally, right before, I was losing my mind. And I wanted to run away. I had never in my life wanted to just run away from whatever I was facing.
International tenor sensation and UNCSA alumnus Rene Barbera. Before him, we heard from Greensboro Opera Artistic Director David Holly. After rounding out last year's season with the Paris, San Francisco, Los Angeles, and Chicago opera companies, just to name a few, Rene returns to the Triad as Tonio in Greensboro Opera's production of Donizetti's The Daughter of the Regiment. He's joined by Metropolitan Opera soprano Ashley Emerson as Marie, and it'll be conducted by Arizona Opera conductor laureate Joel Revzin. It's the featured performance of the 60th Annual National Convention of the National Opera Association, Friday night, January 9th at 8 o'clock, and Sunday the 11th at 2 in Acock Auditorium. There will be a bus service provided to Greensboro for Winston-Salem Opera Buffs, and you'll find links to ticket information and more at WFDD.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend. There is considerable rivalry among the major cities of our state to host the University of North Carolina School of the Arts. It took the intensive combined efforts of visionaries like North Carolina Governor Terry Sanford, author John Ailey, composer Vittorio Giannini, as well as Winston-Salem community leaders, business owners, and citizens to raise the funds that led to North Carolina General Assembly establishing the school in 1963. It opened its doors 2 years later, and the school's incredible first five decades are carefully chronicled in the exhibit, This School, This City, celebrating 50 years of UNC School of the Arts in Winston-Salem at the New Winston Museum. The exhibition's accompanied by an entire season of related programming with musical and theatrical events, lectures, workshops, and more. New Winston Museum Director of Education and Programming, Chris Jordan, is joined by UNCSA Division of Liberal Arts faculty, Mike Wakeford.
I knew as a faculty member at the School of the Arts that we were getting ready to celebrate on an institutional level our 50th anniversary. And I had also recently become, a couple years ago, I became a board member of the New Winston Museum. And this seemed like a fortuitous moment. And I briefly discussed with Chris and Catherine Foster, the executive director at the New Winston Museum, the possibility of partnering the school's 50th with the museum. I approached Jim DeCristo, who was co-chair or is co-chair of the 50th anniversary celebration at UNCSA, about the possibility. And he was very supportive and has remained incredibly supportive of this partnership. And so we began talking about how we might put together an interesting exhibition about the school's history, but also we started wrestling with the question of how could we take the New Winston Museum space and transform it in some way so that it became an expression of the artistic spirit of the School of the Arts. And so we began there. And I guess the other beginning point of the School, This City project was a survey that I developed and have administered over the course of almost a year now, sending a survey out to School of the Arts alumni, former and current faculty and staff, and also just community members and friends of the school. And the survey aimed at gathering personal reflections, personal memories and associations that people have with the school, because we knew we wanted the story that the exhibit told to be a story that was something other than a regular old institutional history, and instead told the story of the school through various different kinds of lenses.
Oh, I love that concept. So then UNCSA, for those of us who love the arts, is an institutional part of this community in a way that it's just hard for me to begin to even articulate. It's so pervasive. With your knowledge, and you're kind of enmeshed in the world of humanities and history, and over 50 years now is a pretty big chunk of time. How do you go about looking at that now?
Yeah, we've talked a lot about that, about the fact that the school, despite becoming a very mature institution at this point, and for many of us, a deeply embedded and ubiquitous presence in town, is still unknown to many. And so I think with the exhibit, we've both honored the fact that a lot of people still don't know the basic story, and so we've tried to tell some of the real core narrative of how the school came to be.
It's a fascinating story in itself, but we'll get into it later.
It is a fascinating story. But in terms of how do we communicate to the local Winston-Salem audience, including people who have no firsthand experience with the school, how do we communicate to them the way that the school has mattered to this community? I think one really important point that we've tried to emphasize is that this school, when it came into being in 1965, became at that moment an important, not first step, but an important early step in the city's rise to becoming the city of arts and then the city of arts and innovation. It's part of the long process of this city's rebranding of itself, re-identification of itself as it exited its industrial age and tried to chart a course toward a new future.
So, Chris, this is a huge part of what you do. I imagine it's interesting for you looking at Winston-Salem through the lens of now this 50th anniversary. What was it like approaching it from the outset?
Oh, sure. Well, when we were first approached to do this collaboration, it was coming at a very interesting time, both for New Winston Museum and for the city itself. So as Mike had mentioned, the city had recently officially rebranded itself as the City of Arts and Innovation. And I think what we wanted to do with this exhibit was tell a story that shows that while we were exiting this industrial age and rebranding ourselves in this community, that the arts and innovation, but primarily the arts and education, had always been a part of this community's identity, and that the school coming here in 1964-65 was not unusual. This was the appropriate place for a school of arts, and it really cemented kind of a progression that had already started some 150, 200 years prior.
We're going back to Moravian times.
Of course, and that's really what we have in mind with the Moravians first settling here in Bethabara, but then in Salem in 1766, almost 200 years before the School of the Arts coming, and really having a focus on not only on music, but on the crafts and on education in general. And that's something that stayed with this community even throughout its industrial era in the late 19th and early 20th century, and into a time when we had a very strong amateur art scene here with the first public arts council in the country. And then on the other side, this was an interesting time in New Winston's history in that we had recently rewritten our mission to include collaboration, so to actively include the word collaboration in our mission. And it was perfect timing for us to be approached and given the opportunity to truly collaborate on something where we would have the creativity and artists from the School of the Arts and a historian from the School of the Arts to work with us to generate something bigger than we could do on our own.
In order to do it, you're kind of, there's a little departure from maybe with a standard curatorial approach to an exhibit. Talk about some of the new aspects of this.
Sure. So me and Mike have joked that this, we call this a distributed curatorship. And in some ways, that I jokingly refer to that as us just giving our responsibilities over to other people to make our jobs easier. But for people like us who are often very interested in controlling the quality and the information that we present, it was actually difficult to give away some of that control. But between ourselves, we had to break up the story that we were telling between responsibilities. And then also the design and creation of the exhibit was done by a UNCSA scene design student, constructed by students from the School of the Arts. Several other aspects, audio and visual aspects of the exhibit were really allowed to be generated and created by others with little oversight from us. There were a lot of anxious times, I think, wondering whether or not we were going to pull this off, but it turned out beautifully, I think.
Why is it important for me, the triad liver, or someone from out of town, to hear this story?
The UNCSA story is a story of this community. I don't think you can really segregate stories in that way. They all happen for a reason, and it happened at a very interesting and important time in this city's history. So I think in and of that, it's integrated, and it has been. The school has been so integrated into the economic and cultural scene of this city for the last 50 plus years. So I think it's important in that sense. But also for the museum's sake, it's telling fresh stories. I think that's what we want to do. We are a small institution right now. We don't have the space to curate and maintain a permanent exhibit on the broader history of Winston-Salem and do these more temporary exhibits. So we decided to try to tell fresh stories that maybe will be have built-in audiences that are smaller, but they, I think, are important stories for us to realize that we are all connected in different ways.
Through the preparation, the curatorial aspect of this, your involvement and delegating and just your research, what's come out through this that's something you've learned that's really interested you that you didn't know about before?
Well, in the first few years of the institution's history, and it, from its founding through its establishment, it was always insecure, both from a legislative standpoint. It was never sure that it was going, that the legislation was going to pass, and then early on it was finding the funding, finding the faculty, Giannini twisting arms and convincing people to come down here to be the faculty for this, what was a radical institution. You know, in the first year only had a couple hundred students, and I think you had one building over the old Gray High School, and it had to be renovated to even make place for a school. So I think it was really interesting to see how it's matured from this ragtag kind of radical institution into something that we couldn't see ourselves without today.
Mike, in this community, I'll be honest with you, you asked 10 different people how UNCSA began, who was most responsible, you'll get 10 different answers. Was it John Ailey? Was it the governor? Was it Phil Haynes? Was it any number of people? Walk us back. You're just getting up to speed here, and you alluded to it, Chris, just how tenuous the situation was going into creating this school. I believe the first conservatory for both high school and college students that was a public institution in the whole country.
Right. One of the School of the Arts' great claims to fame is that it was the first state-supported arts conservatory in the nation. The question of, you know, who really is responsible for the beginning of the school is indeed an often asked and much talked about one. And it's a question that actually led to the writing of the school's first institutional history, which was authored in the mid-1980s by Leslie Banner. And we actually just had the pleasure of having Leslie Banner and Doug Zinn, who is now Assistant Executive Director of the Kenan Charitable Trust, but who at the time was working for Jim and Mary Siemens at the Mary Duke Biddle Foundation in Durham, and who, at an earlier point in his career, did an oral history project aimed at discovering answers to some of these very questions. And the answer isn't a simple one, but the names that are most associated with the founding of the school are John Ealy, now one of the revered citizens of Winston-Salem, who, as a young faculty member at UNC Chapel Hill in the early 1960s, began to raise questions about whether a traditional liberal arts educational institution was the right place to produce professional artists in the performing arts. A concern that John Ealy articulated in a really interesting and provocative way caught the eyes of a new governor, Terry Sanford of North Carolina, in the early 60s, so much so that John Ealy became a member of Terry Sanford's staff in the early 60s. And from there, he began to develop an idea that maybe the time was right for a southern state, North Carolina, to have a performing arts conservatory. That idea that John Ealy and Terry Sanford began to incubate combined along the way with a dream of some other folks. Vittorio Giannini, who of course became the first president of the School of the Arts in 1964 prior to its opening in 1965, was a successful American composer from Philadelphia who spent many a summer at the Brevard Music Center here in North Carolina, which was run at the time by a Winston-Salem native and the son of a Moravian bishop, James Christian Fole. Fole happened to catch Governor Sanford's ear in 1961 at one of President John Kennedy's and Jackie Kennedy's first young people's concerts at the White House. And when Terry Sanford said he'd been talking to some of Fole's students and learning that if they wanted to pursue a professional future as musicians, they would have to leave the state, Governor Sanford talked to James Christian Fole about this and said, "What can we do?" And James Christian Fole, as the story goes, said to Governor Sanford, "Well, I've always had a dream, and it's a dream I share with my friend Vittorio Giannini. We share a dream of a performing arts conservatory in the South." And so the dream of Fole and Giannini on the one side and Ealy and Governor Sanford and others combined over the next few months. And by 1963, it had taken the form of a bill, which was, though a heavy lift, successfully passed through the North Carolina legislature. And then the School of the Arts was really off to the races.
I've never quite gotten Terry's investment in this. Was he into the arts in a big way? Why did he care so much? Because this was not a politically popular thing to try to do back then.
I think Governor Sanford was interested in new ideas. I think he wanted to be a new kind of leader for a new North Carolina. And it appealed to him to come up with ambitious initiatives that could be funded primarily with private money. This was a very forward-thinking idea that one way to make a state progress into a new future was to do things that would not necessarily rely wholly on the public dollar. And so a huge piece involved in the story of how the School of the Arts came to be was that once the school was chartered and once the state of North Carolina had put a little bit of money into the pot for it, what remained necessary was for a great city to be chosen as a host, for a physical site in that city to be found, for a great plan for an art school to be put together. And then and only then would the Ford Foundation, located in New York City, and at the time with an arts program led by a fellow named Mac Lowry, only then would a $5 million over five-year grant be let loose. And that grant really was the critical mass of monies that allowed the School of the Arts to become a reality and start to thrive in its opening years.
So, Mike, I mean, I'll be the naysayer here. Why should I go to an exhibit and find out about how a school began? What's the big deal?
Well, I'd say two things. One, if you go to this exhibit, you get to walk in the front door and immediately see a sculpture made of 37,000 paper cups and 100,000 staples that climbs from floor to ceiling and undulates its way up into the ceiling and then down the exterior wall. So it's, for one thing, it's just a great free exhibit where moms and dads can take kids and know that the kids are going to see something spectacular and be entertained for 15, 20 minutes while mom and dad learn a few things about an important institution. I guess what I would say a little more seriously is that I think we all know that in recent years, institutions of public higher education in this state have seen some tough times for a variety of reasons. And those of us who work at or who have attended or who simply live in proximity to institutions of the University of North Carolina know that it is absolutely essential that we get better and more aggressive about telling the communities that host us and telling the communities where we live just what it is that we do on those campuses, like School of the Arts, and also to thank the communities for all that they've done for us. This is a really important relationship, the relationship between the city of Winston-Salem and the University of North Carolina School of the Arts is a really important relationship and one that's mutually beneficial in so many different ways. And those of us who care about these institutions and care about the cities that host them just know that in the 21st century, our job increasingly becomes telling that story in creative new ways that reach out and tell it to people who might not otherwise know it. That's good for all involved.
But what are some highlights from it? Put me in the seat there. Put me in the museum itself. I'll start with you, Mike, since you've got the mic in front of you there. What stands out in your eyes?
Well, I think in addition to the sculpture that we call the climber that's made of the paper cups and staples, I think one of the features of the exhibit that people will really enjoy are some of the recently digitized archival video that comes out of the university archives. Those vintage videos include video and sound of President Vittorio Giannini, who many know was the first president of the school, a charismatic American composer, a real dreamer with a thick Philadelphia accent. And many of us have heard his name, have heard about his importance to the history of the school, but have never heard him talk, and nor really seen him in action. Another piece of video features actual film footage of the famous Dial for Dollars campaign, that long weekend in which the community members raised almost $1 million and really secured the school for the city of Winston-Salem. Amazing images of the city and regular community members making those phone calls. There's a wonderful story that ran on the Today Show in 1976 that's introduced by a young Barbara Walters, a 4 or 5 minute feature profile about this school, which at that point was 10 years old and you know, really starting to gain a reputation for itself. Also, for music lovers, they'll really enjoy seeing a clip of the famous American composer Aaron Copland when he visited here on his 70th birthday in, I believe, 1972, and worked with the student orchestra and conducted and performed with them and had some really kind words to say about the school. So there's just wonderful vintage video to see that folks will really, really appreciate.
New Winston Museum Director of Education and Programming Chris Jordan and UNCSA Division of Liberal Arts faculty Mike Wakeford. This school, this city, celebrating 50 years of UNC School of the Arts in Winston-Salem at the New Winston Museum, includes film footage of the school's first president, Vittorio Giannini, live theater, original composition performances, and a sculpture composed of 37,000 drinking cups. Coming up on Wednesday night, February 4th, the talented students from the studio of renowned UNCSA guitarist and teacher Joseph Pecoraro will perform a recital titled Strings of Connection. Then, on the 11th, it's two chancellors on a stage at UNCSA's Friedman Theater. It'll be a public dialogue between current UNCSA Chancellor Lindsay Bierman and former Chancellor Alex Ewing. They'll discuss leading an arts conservatory in Winston-Salem. You'll find links to more information about the entire goings-on at the museum on our website, wfdd.org, and click on Triad Arts Weekend. Southern Constellations is a National Endowment for the Arts-funded curatorial project now in its second season at Elsewhere, Greensboro's Living Museum. The fellowship program brings six dynamic artist teams from across our region for special residencies at Elsewhere, and each team explores experimental art in the South. Composer, soprano saxophonist, ethnomusicologist, and educator Andrew Raffo Dewar was among the first group of Southern Constellations fellows to work on site at Elsewhere. In 2013, the assistant professor of interdisciplinary arts in New College and the School of Music at the University of Alabama spent 2 weeks at Elsewhere creating a graphic and tactile score entitled Material Music, and we're sampling from a live performance recording of that work right now. When you think of Western classical music, you might picture a series of dots and lines on a page. Through his work as a noted performer, Andrew is well acquainted with this traditional system of notation, but his musical background extends far beyond the traditional. From his longtime involvement in experimental Indonesian music and recordings with NEA jazz master Anthony Braxton and the Bill Dixon Orchestra, to performances with musicians from around the world, Andrew has pushed the boundaries of how music is shared and interpreted.
The material music series that I've been building at Elsewhere takes that a step further, and instead of just drawing images on paper, I'm actually making images through the found objects from Elsewhere, which is this giant former thrift store now turned into a living museum. And so I'm taking these objects, composing with them, organizing them spatially, and then fixing them to a backing board as a score. And so we then interpret these symbols, three-dimensional symbols, and also fabric. So there's a tactile aspect to it as well. As you feel the fabric, you feel the texture of the object, and then you can sort of interpret that into the texture of your sound or the timbre of your sound. And also the color of the fabrics and the color of the objects is another way to interpret these forms.
It really is that much in the hands of the performer.
Absolutely. And there's different ways of doing that. You can decide as a group, as we did in the recordings, how we would interpret it. Allowing musicians to explore and express themselves outside the bounds of the composition is part of the tradition I'm connected to. But this takes it to a whole nother level where you literally walk into the room and ask the audience, what are we going to play? How are we going to play this? And you're the instrument. So the audience becomes the orchestra. And that's definitely a new level of handing over of control for me. And it's exciting. It's also terrifying. I was really impressed with how sensitive the audience was. Primarily non-musicians. I think there was only one or two people who would consider themselves musicians. But everybody was very sensitive. Everybody was listening to one another. It would be very easy for someone to just come in and make a lot of noise and not pay attention and not care. But everybody was very sensitive and trying to make music. They took it seriously. And I think it was partly because I said, it's up to you. You're in charge of making this piece of music here, using the score as our guide. And I think people rose to the challenge.
Composer, improviser, woodwind instrumentalist, and ethnomusicologist, Southern Constellations fellow Andrew Raffo Dewar. His graphic score, Material Music, was performed by local musicians at Elsewhere, a living museum set in a three-story former thrift store during Elsewhere's inaugural Southern Constellations curatorial project. You'll find links to Andrew's recordings at wfdd.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend. You'll find photos of his material music scores there as well. Elsewhere is now accepting applications for residency and fellowship opportunities, staff positions, internships, and university retreats. Deadlines are coming up this month. Well, that's all for today's program. Our technical producer is Eddie Garcia. Our associate producer is Bethany Chafin. And you'll find podcasts, archived episodes, and links to all of our guests and events and more on our website, WFDD.org. Just be sure and click on Triad Arts Weekend. And as always, if you have questions, comments, or suggestions, we'd love to hear from you. Send us an email. That address is triadarts@wfu.edu. I'm David Ford. Thanks for listening to Triad Arts Weekend.